All right. Now I'm going to warn you, I've got an absolutely shocking memory. I can't remember a thing to save my life. So I've got my notes. I'm going to try not to read from them because that's really sucky. My name's Lana Brindley, for those of you who I haven't met, most of you who I haven't met since this is my first LCA. I'm Loquacity on IRC. You might have seen me hanging around there. I'm a technical writer for Red Hat. I'm really, really passionate about what I do. I'm scarily passionate about what I do. It's really probably a good idea not to come up to me in the street and say, "Hey, Lana, what do you think about tech writing?" Because I'll tell you. They don't call me Loquacity for nothing. Assuming that you're mostly of the engineering bent more than the writing bent, I really want to talk to you today about how what I do every day interacts with what you guys do every day. There's a big link there, and it's not often explored, well, other than by people like me. The fact is that documentation is all too often it's overlooked in open source projects. Open source projects are quite often built by really small teams of dedicated individuals, and as such, they tend to view documentation as a little bit of a nicety. There's not often the budget to be able to hire writers. Even if there is the budget, they're probably going to spend it on something else rather than getting a writer in. Writers just aren't seen as being that important. First of all, I will give you a little potted history of myself. I do like being a little bit self-indulgent sometimes. There really is no clear path that's going to lead you through out of high school, through university, and into a tech writing career. And that's actually, it's probably a good thing, really. But what it does mean is that for every tech writer you meet, they've got a pretty interesting story. I don't know if mine's as interesting as some I've heard, but I find it interesting. And it's also interesting in light of some of the conversations I've been having over the last day or two since I've arrived. Very few teenagers get to school and say, "Hey, when I grow up, I want to be a tech writer." Partly that's because the career isn't well advertised in a lot of ways. I didn't know what a tech writer was, and I think until I was 22. And at that point, I decided I wanted to be one. I started out in uni doing what I like to refer to as a default degree. Other people call it an arts degree. I lasted about 9 months before I realised that it was totally not what I wanted to do. And I farted around for a little while, and eventually I graduated with a Bachelor of Business Management. I majored in information systems and marketing, which was kind of cool. And then I got out of university and I freaked out and I had no idea what to do, so I went and worked in retail for a while. And after I'd done that for a bit, I decided to go back and do a postgraduate course because I felt comfortable at uni. So I did a postgraduate course and I got my MBA. And then after that, I ran my own business for a while because that's supposedly what you're supposed to do when you've got an MBA. And I didn't enjoy it all that much. And so then I worked for a couple of tech startups and started, rather than just being one of these people who wandered around going, "Yeah, I really like gadgetry," I actually started working with it. And it was someone at one of those startups who is to blame for both introducing me to tech writing and also introducing me to open source. So he has an awful lot to answer for. And before long, it wasn't long before that particular startup we were working for folded. I started looking for another job. Red Hat was there, and I just went, "Hey, how awesome would it be to interview for Red Hat?" They interviewed me, and then they actually hired me, so that was kind of cool. I've been with Red Hat for nearly 3 years now. I still love it, which is more than what I can say for any of my previous jobs. I think I've got the best job in the world. And they're hiring, incidentally. Enough about me. Let's talk about tech writing. Open source projects, I think I've already said, are created by really small teams of people who are passionate about it and they're dedicated. What this means is that documentation tends to end up as an afterthought if it happens at all. What generally occurs is the people who end up writing the documentation are the people who've dreamed up the project, they've been working on it for however many months, and they're really, really close to the minutiae of what's going on. They really understand the detail of what's happening. And that makes them really bad for writing documentation. It means that you start writing documentation at about this level, and then they get harder up here. And when you've got a user who comes to the project for the very first time, they don't know what they're doing. They get to the first page, and they go, "Holy crap, I can't work this out. What do I do now?" They throw the documentation away, and with it, they throw the project away, and you'll never see them again. Standard usability guides, usability guidelines for software development, which I'm sure you're all familiar with, they actually map across to documentation really well. And it's important to get the focus put back on the user, focus on what the user wants to achieve, focus on what their learning abilities are and that kind of thing. And that's what's going to get you users from just using the software because they have to, and on to actually enjoying using the software. And they're the people who become your evangelists. These are the best customers you can possibly have. In order to illustrate this, and has anyone seen this before? Is there any Canberra people here? Oh, good, it's a brand new audience, I love it. I've told this one a few times before. It's a fairy tale, I like to call it technical writing a fairy tale. It is actually going to make it very clear to you that I've missed my calling by becoming a technical writer. I probably should have become an animator for Pixar, maybe. I reckon I could have done really well at Pixar. Anyway, once upon a time, and this slide's a bit funny sometimes, once upon a time in a faraway kingdom, there we go, there lived a woman called Jane. Where's Jane? I have problems with the slides. Here's Jane. Jane was a software engineer, and you can tell that because she's got a laptop. One day, Jane had a really brilliant idea. Her idea was going to make things way easier for everyone in the kingdom who used a computer. I told you I had a bad memory, didn't I? To make the idea into reality, she was going to need a little bit of help. So she called... Oh, that's her idea. Sorry. She was going to need a little bit of help. So she called Fred. Fred was really good at making things look pretty and making them easy to use. Then she called Sue. Sue was really good at making places for data to be stored. Then she called Bob. Nobody was quite sure what Bob could do, but he made really good coffee. So, one fine, sunny Monday morning, Jane, Fred, Sue and Bob all sat down and started working on the project together. Jane started writing the code, Sue looked after the back end, Fred made it all look really wonderful, and Bob made coffee. Every project needs a Bob. On Tuesday, they all sat down to work again. Bob came in from the kitchen with the coffee. He says to the others, look, how are our customers going to know how to use this software? Sue said, my database is so clean and organized that it's just going to work without any problems whatsoever. On Wednesday, they'd all gotten to work again. And when Bob came in from the kitchen with the coffee, he said it again. How are our customers going to know how to use this software? Jane said, well, I'm such a good programmer. I write such clean, organized code that the system will just be as easy as anything to use. Besides, it's written in Python. What else do they need? On Thursday, Bob walked into the coffee. He says, I still don't understand how our customers are going to learn how to use this software. Fred said, my designs will be so good that users will just be able to work it without any problem whatsoever. On Friday, everyone was getting a little bit tired and worn out, and they all just wanted the project to be finished already. So Bob came in with Red Bull for everyone and said, but how are our customers going to know how to use this software? So Jane turned around and asked him, very politely, how Bob thought it should be done. Bob said that perhaps they should be writing a user manual for the software. That way, anyone who couldn't work out what they were doing would be able to look up the documentation, and that would explain how to use it. Sue frowned. My database is very well organized, she said. Jane scowled. My code is very well written, she said. Fred looked troubled. My design is very good, but maybe a user manual will help those people who are too stupid to be able to work it out for themselves. Jane says, but who's going to write it? We don't have any technical writers. Bob said, I've read lots of manuals. I know I used to write a newsletter for my social club. I'll write the manual. No one else wanted the job, so they all let Bob get on with it. Bob worked all weekend, while the others went home and played Xbox. On Monday, they were ready to package the software and ship it. Bob had finished the manual, and they all agreed that it had a nice shiny cover. The software went out, and they waited. On Tuesday morning, the phone started ringing. Because your phones look like this, don't they? Yeah. It was customers wanting to know how to install the software. It's easy, they said. It's all in the user manual. On Wednesday, the phones kept ringing. It was customers wanting to know how to work the software. It's easy, they said. It's all in the manual. On Thursday morning, the phones stopped ringing. Jane decided to read the manual. Joan's face went red. Do you like my Photoshop skills? Which I think was GIMP. I think I used GIMP. Then it went purple. She had suddenly realised why the phones weren't ringing. On Friday morning, the software team started looking for new jobs. Jane's brilliant idea that could have made everyone's lives so much easier rested in a drawer, and the manuals got used to line all the budgie and hamster cages in the kingdom. So what's the moral of the story? Just because you can read a manual doesn't mean you can write one. Manuals are absolutely critical to the success of any open source project, but it only works if they're planned and executed with the same care that you plan and execute the rest of the project with. Don't assume that your customers are going to know how to use the software without any help whatsoever. Don't assume that they're stupid either, though. If they're smart enough to want your software, they're smart enough to want decent documentation as well. Now, this, I promise, is the most boring slide in the deck, and it's probably the one I spend the most time on, so I apologise in advance. What I'm going to do is just try and give you a really quick overview of how we at Red Hat produce documentation. It's a good general plan for anyone. It's a five-phase process. It's been developed by a woman by the name of Joanne Hakos. Who's heard of Joanne Hakos? None of you are in project management, clearly. Project management or documentation, if you're working in either of those fields, read Hakos. I thoroughly recommend it. You will not get better advice. First of all, we start off with... Does my laser pointer work? Hey! First off, we start with an information plan. This takes up 10% of the project. We basically decide on the name of the book, the topics it's going to cover, who the audience is, which of course is very important, and also the style of the document. You might be bound by corporate rules like I am. You might just be doing your own thing and you need to develop this kind of information. You can, at this point, we also schedule out the entire project. We work out how many days we've got, how many pages we can create, what topics we can cover. It's also the part where you get to ring your project manager up and you go, hey, you know, if you want a book that's this covers this many topics, well, that's great, but if I've only got 3 days to put it in, then you're going to get this many topics. That's just the way it is. And so then they go, oh, all right, no problem. We'll either give you more time or, okay, just run with 3 topics. Next phase is content spec. This takes up about 20% of the project, and this is where we identify where we're getting our information from. Normally, in most cases, this is from a subject matter expert or an SMA. It can also be there's a body of work that exists out there. There might be a wiki, there might be documentation that already exists, there might be a book that you can go down to the bookshop and buy. It might be all, a range of things, it might be a combination of all those things. It's also where we sit down and work out the broad structure of the book. We already know how much time we've got to develop it. Now we're going to work out what the book looks like. We're going to get the title of the book, the chapter headings, the section headings. We're going to work out what information will go into the main body of work, what's going to go into the appendix. We work out what's going to make it into this revision, what's going to happen at, you know, 1.2. Then comes the fun part, if you're me. This is writing. This takes 50% of our time, so it really is the main important part. If any of you know a writer, you'll probably recognise this. It's basically the point where you close the door, you turn Twitter off, for me, turn Twitter off, and you put your head down and you just write. You get in a dark room and you're never seen from again for the next few weeks, and sometimes months. At the end of that phase, we actually let our baby out into the world, and we hand it over to the subject matter experts and the technical team for technical review. That's to make sure that we've actually, you know, we haven't said that, haven't described something in a completely incorrect way or whatever, something that might be a bit too technical for some of us poor writers. We also put the book through quality assurance. Sometimes there's two levels of quality assurance. There might be a more technical one and one that's actually, that goes with the documentation team. They basically check processes more than anything else to make sure that we haven't introduced any errors there. We also send it through peer review. Peer review finds all the typos, hopefully, all the typos. And we also send it through an editorial review. The editorial review is really important. It makes sure that our language is correct, that our trademarks and copyrights have all been handled properly. And they also check that the book is consistent with the rest of the books in the suite. So in the case of Red Hat, we don't want to publish a book that looks and feels completely different to the rest of Red Hat documentation. It needs to be consistent. After all the hard work comes translation. I hope we haven't got any translators here in the audience. Oh, don't hit me. Basically, translation takes 20% of the time. They call it 19 to make it add up properly. And we hand basically the whole sorry mess over to the translating team and let them do their magic. It's also officially where production takes place. Because we don't print books on dead trees anymore, well, not so much, not in Red Hat anyway, that basically means just rolling it up into HTML and PDF formats and throwing it up on the web. It takes about 23 and a half minutes generally. After the whole thing's gone off, we've got to release. The software's gone out. With any luck, the books were made available at more or less the same time. The translations are up. Sometimes they lag behind by a little bit, but they're usually up within a few days. And then we have this quick little 1% on the end here that we do a review. Because of the distributed nature of a company like Red Hat, what that generally means is a phone hookup. We get on with the subject matter expert, project manager, anyone else who's interested, and say, hey, how was it for you? And of course, the answer is always, yeah, it was awesome. Do it again the same next time. Well, not always, but we try. Okay, now, that's the mechanics of how it's done. Like writing code, though, it's very easy to say, well, you know, you do this, and then you do that, and then you hum away to yourself, and then it's done. In there somewhere is magic. And what I really want to talk to you about is the difference between magic and more magic. The problem with writing software, well, most software, certainly any software that's going to make you, well, this is open source, any software that's going to make you famous, if not rich, is that software is written by you. You make it easy to use, you make it simple to work out, but that only holds true for someone who thinks exactly like you do. Unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, because I haven't met all of you yet, unfortunately, only you think like you do. You can try and put yourself in somebody else's shoes, but it's not only extraordinarily difficult to do, it's not their shoes that are working the software anyway. Okay. Pop quiz. Who can tell me what this is about? Come on, we've got engineers in the audience. Yeah, that too. I tried to make it as big as I could. Okay, take a look at this one. It's a really simple example, but what I'm trying to impress on you is how important documentation in all its forms, including code comments, can be. In open source, code commenting is even more important than in any other situation, any other proprietary software. And that's because it's not just the developers who are looking at the code and wanting to know what's going on. The problem with this openness is that you don't know who's going to be looking at that. You don't know how savvy these people are. You might have someone who's looking to contribute. You might have someone who's learning a new programming language. You might have someone who's looking to steal it to put in their own code. You might have someone like me who wants to put it in front of a bunch of hapless conference goers. I don't know what that's about. I have no idea. I'm not a programmer. I actually do know the person who wrote it, though, if that helps. Having well-commented code is just as important as any other part of the project, and it can make the difference between people understanding or not understanding. It can make the difference between people saying wonderful things about your product. It can make the difference between people saying crap about your project. It can make the difference between people contributing or not contributing. Make sure the comments are good. Okay, let's put commenting aside just for a moment. Oh no, it doesn't want to. There we go. I just want to try and impress on you just a little bit more about how important documentation is, not just to software in general, but particularly to open source. Does anyone recognize this? You know, tell me what it is. Well done. I need some of Saz's lollies. It's called the Lion's Commentary on Unix. I'm told I've only got 1 minute left, but my... I'm told I've only got a minute left, but my talk is going to run way over. Is this going to be a major problem? Can I keep going? Sorry? Am I not interesting? I've got lollies now.
I can let you go until 2 o'clock at the latest.
Oh, am I not interesting? This.
No, you are, really.
Yeah, right.
It's documentation. How interesting can it be? This is the 1996 edition. It originally came out in 76. It's impossible to find a picture of it. If anyone can email me a picture of the 76... That would be awesome. Thanks. It was written by this guy. His name, incidentally, is John Lyons. Now, I think we all more or less understand what this book is about. Basically, I'm going to try and rush through it. Unix was released in the mid-70s. Mr. Lyons was working for the University of Sydney. He thought it was fantastic. Was it UNSW? I thought it was Uni of Sydney. My apologies. One of those Sydney ones, anyway. And his words were that it was intrinsically interesting, and he basically shoved it in front of his students. It was the first time that students anywhere had seen great bodies of work in the size of something like an OS and had been able to study somebody else's code like that. So it really was quite amazing. It became the single thing that was responsible for what allowed this guy to do what he did. We all know who he is. And it became the single thing that was responsible for what he created. Linux would not be here if it was not for documentation like the Lyons commentary. So the real thing is, who says a book can't change the world? The real question we have to ask is, how do we create documentation that changes the world? It's a lofty goal, but if we put it back into perspective, when you create a bit of software, what's the point of that bit of software? What's the point of any software? Any ideas? Solve a problem, absolutely. It's to make life easier. We make it easier to use the software than we do to do the original thing that they were trying to achieve. We make the software easy to use. The way we make the software easy to use, the way we make it available, is by having good documentation. And so that leads us into this, which is what I call a quick how-to. It's called writing FOSS docs that don't suck. We all know that no one reads the manual, and I'm going to skip over a bit here. But when you buy a new TV, what do you do? You open the box, you pull the TV out, you plug it in. You've got the box, you've got the styrofoam bits, you've got the spare widget, and you've got the manual. And you throw it all out, it goes out next bin day, and you never think about it again. What do if you can't work it? You mash buttons until you get it to do what it is you want it to do. That's because we're all fairly technical people. We wouldn't be here if we weren't. And we understand the language that's used in menus. We understand how that kind of stuff works. We understand that if we want to change the way the picture is displayed, you need to look for words like brightness, contrast, hue, saturation. We understand the language. There are a few types of manual readers. I'm not going to go through them. I'm running out of time. I'm sure you all know people who read manuals in different ways. And let's move right along. Why document? The really compelling reason to document, in a nutshell, is because documentation reduces support calls. There are heaps and heaps and heaps of case studies out there how good documentation and improving documentation can make a difference on all other areas of the business. I'm going to skip through all this now. We know that documentation is not just important, but it's also used in a huge amount of different ways. Because I just talked about it for the last 10 minutes. You heard that, didn't you? Bit like software. So, okay, what makes your software awesome? What makes your software easy to use? What is it about your software that makes people want to come back and use it again? What is it about the software that makes people tell their friends about it? It all really boils down to something that's really, really simple and we all deal with, regardless of what part of the business you work in. We all deal with this every day. It's called software usability. Software usability maps across to documentation really, really well. I'm sure I've probably got a couple of usability people here today. No one's game to put their hands up, but please don't bash me afterwards. I'm really going to just whiz through this. I'm just going to hit some highlights, and I'm certainly not going into the whole usability field. Just going to look at a couple of them and map them across to documentation just because I find it an interesting exercise. First up, learnability. Learnability is about layout. It's about language. It's about how the information is structured. It's starting with basic concepts in the early chapters and then building on that knowledge through it. Does each chapter provide a concept description followed by a process, followed by an example to be able to hit those different types of manual readers? Does it have big words where little words will do? If you're interpreting words from an engineer, how much passive voice is there? Turn those sentences around so that they're active again. Efficiency. Efficiency is a really delicate balance. It's the balance between how much information you include and how long the book is. We want the user to have all the information that they need to operate it, but we don't want to hand them a set of encyclopedias as well. we need to be able to condense it down for them. Even though people do actually read manuals, much as many would argue that we don't, most people do it because they have to. They don't do it because they enjoy it like a good, sci-fi paperback. Try to make the task as easy and as painless as possible for them. Retention. I love my elephant. He's cute. Okay.
I'm sorry about the time fuck up. I mean, mistake.
I'm nearly.
But Angela has to go and...
Yeah, no, that's all right. I understand.
I am so sorry.
That's okay. Basically, if I can just skip right to the end, I'm going to skip past all this. All right. When users love the software, it's great software. It's going to be a credit to you. It's going to be awesome. If the software doesn't work exactly as expected, even if it's for 1% of the people, the documentation should be there to save you. Beautiful documentation won't make crappy software any better, but it might stop some users from trying to stab you. Thank you very much.